commanders. The Associated Press says the death toll for U.S. troops in Afghanistan this month now stands at more than 30. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Kabul.
Funeral services today for the great-granddaughter of anti-apartheid icon Nelson Mandela. Zanani Mandela was killed in a car crash last week after a World Cup concert in Soweto. She was 13 years old. Former South African President Mandela made a rare public appearance today to attend the funeral. The 91-year-old appeared frail, but he occasionally smiled during the service as a troupe of singers and dancers performed in Zanani's honor. In Colombia, at least 16 miners have been killed in an explosion overnight. Authorities say dozens more miners are still missing. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Child Fund International, providing food, water, and medicine to children in poverty through child sponsorship. Learn more at childfund.org.
Think a tiny ant can't hurt you? Some species can sting, bite, and even overwhelm and kill prey 10,000 times their size. Take the African driver ant.
They have jaws like knives, and so they can cut human flesh.
On the Next Fresh Air, ant expert Mark Moffitt. Join us for the Next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
And this is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls. Next year, the world's most powerful supercomputer will be coming online. It is called Blue Waters, and scientists all across this country will be using it in their work. The computer itself is here on the campus of the University of Illinois. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll find out what makes Blue Waters so special. Perhaps talk a little bit about how it is that Urbana was selected to be its home. And our guest for the program is Tom Dunning. He's the director of the Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies and the National Center for Supercomputing Applications here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He also holds an endowed position as Distinguished Chair for Research Excellence in Chemistry and is a professor in the Department of Chemistry. And we're pleased that you could be here and to talk a little bit about Blue Waters and about supercomputing. One reason for also doing the program today is that we'd also would like to mention that there will be an open house today at the new National Petascale Computing Facility. That's this afternoon from 4 to 6. This is the building that will house Blue Waters. And we were just talking, and he was saying that this is for the general public. This will be your one chance if you'd like to see what that building looks like inside. See what's going on in there. You can stop by today from 4 to 6. You'd be welcome, and they'll kind of show you around. And, of course, here on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted to be here. This is a major new happening in Champaign-Urbana, and so we're very interested in having the public see what the insides of a supercomputing facility look like.
Well, I'm sure having this machine here is a great thing for the University of Illinois, and that it will also be an important tool for scientists here and elsewhere, all over, will be able to use it in their research.
Yes, this is really going to be a very unique facility, not just in the United States, but actually worldwide. As you probably know, there are supercomputing centers that have been established or are being established in almost all of the major countries. China, for example, now has a major new program in bringing supercomputing to the country. But the thing that is very unique about this facility, is that it is the only one that's going to be on a university campus. Basically, all of the rest of these big facilities are in the national laboratories in the countries that they're in. So this is really a unique opportunity to integrate supercomputing into the fabric of education, education both at the graduate level and eventually at the undergraduate level. Mm-hmm. So this is a very unique opportunity for the University of Illinois, and it was a very hard-fought competition, as you can imagine.
Yeah. And just to pick up on this point again a little bit, we were talking about this before we got going. There are, here in the United States, the Department of Energy, the as you explained to me, the National Security Agency, the government has some very powerful machines, but they are machines that are only for the government's use. This would be the most powerful machine that scientists, you know, no matter what kind of research that they're doing, that this would be the most powerful machine that they could take advantage of.
That's correct. And it's important here to emphasize the powerful part of it, because when we were working with IBM to develop and configure this machine, we weren't looking for the maximum number of arithmetic operations that it could carry out per second, although I can tell you it is an astounding number. What we were looking for was a computer that a broad range of scientists could use to support their research. Whether you're doing research in cosmology, trying to understand how the universe was formed, trying to model earthquakes or tornadoes in the world that we live in, or really trying to understand the nanoscale world, whether it's biology or whether it's nanomaterials, this machine can do all of that.
Now, I have read some things about this, and I've read these statistics or the information on the performance of the machine. And it said that this would be the first system of its kind to sustain one petaflop performance and 10 at peak. And I really don't know what exactly that means. And can you make some comparisons so that for your layperson, non-computer expert, that will actually mean something?
Yeah, you know, David, one of the things that's interesting about supercomputing technology is that even though this is something I do as a living, these numbers still astound me. So 10 to the 15th, that is a million billion arithmetic operations per second. So what is that? So an arithmetic operation per second is you take two 14-digit numbers, you multiply them together to get another 14-digit number. Mm-hmm. That's a typical arithmetic operation. Now, if you could do that once every second, which is a no mean feat in and of itself, it would take you 31 million years to do what Blue Waters does in 1 second.
Okay,
so as I say, the numbers are astounding.
Yeah, I still don't quite get that somehow. And as I was looking at it, and I hope that I have this correct, another thing that sort of boggled my mind was the number of cores that the machine has. Now, I'm thinking that, okay, now today sort of your standard for personal computer is we have dual core processors. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't all that long ago that the standard was a single core. There was one core. So, I mean, to me at least, I know, okay, two is better than one. It makes it go faster. Okay, dual core, good. Now we have some PCs that have quad core. They have four. And you can get 8 and you can get 16. So it can be scaled up and you can understand, okay, the more cores, the better you are. Your machine has 200,000 cores, right?
Well, it's the number we're giving out now is actually 300,000.
300,000. Oh, and even better.
This is a machine that is defining the future of IBM's Power Series line of computers. As you can imagine, they have been very reluctant to release information on the details of the computer too far in advance. So these numbers keep changing with time, but I can tell you that 300,000 is actually pretty close to the final number. It'll be more than 300,000, but it won't be 400,000, and it won't even be 350,000.
Yeah, okay. Now, and I guess I know enough about this to think that even if you say you have a dual core processor, that you have to have some way for your machine to figure out how those two cores work together. Now, I think, well, that's probably hard enough, but I'm expecting that the challenge to get 300,000 cores together, that's a big thing.
David, you've hit on exactly the problem that really confronts computational scientists and engineers. As you say, it's one thing to get a dual-core, a quad-core, even an 8-core machine, to get all the cores to work together on a problem. Getting 300,000 of them to work together on a problem is really a monumental challenge. And this is something that the scientists and engineers involved in high-performance computing have been facing for a number of years. We've come up with a lot of clever solutions to the problem, but Blue Waters really raises the bar on all of this. So one of the aspects, actually, of the Blue Waters project is that we're working with IBM to try to develop a set of tools that will allow scientists and engineers to much more easily harness these 300,000 cores to do the job that they want them to do.
Is it a matter of taking whatever problem that you're working on or task that you're assigning and breaking it into a lot of small pieces and giving each core a little piece, say, you know, you take this piece and you take this piece and you take this piece, and then you have to then, the results or the work that each core does, then you're going to have to, it's like a big jigsaw puzzle, you're going to have to take those pieces and put it back together again into something that
that's
a total picture.
That's exactly what has to be done. So you have to look at the computational task that you have before you, typically solving some type of mathematical equation, and understand how you can take that task and break it up into the pieces so that each of the 300,000 cores can start work on their piece. The difficulty in all of that is that you also have to minimize the amount of time that a core has to stop and ask another core what it's doing. It would be like digging a ditch in which, if you aren't careful, if people have to be constantly talking to one another as opposed to digging, the ditch isn't going to get dug any faster. So it's really orchestrating all of this that is the source of the difficulty.
And is the big advantage that you get here that the task or the problem it can be working on is it can be much more complicated than a slower computer, or is it a matter that maybe a slower computer could do it, but it would take it a lot longer than, you know, it could take, you know, who knows how long to figure out the problem, and you just don't, you can't take 5 years or something like that for it to do the job.
Because of the way that that Blue Waters is configured, there will be types of problems that one can solve on Blue Waters that it just doesn't matter how long another computer could work on it. They'll never be able to solve it. So that's one, again, one of the unique aspects of Blue Waters. And by the way, you mentioned about the cores, and that's something that people are starting to get familiar with, because as you mentioned, even the laptop computer you use undoubtedly has dual cores in it. But this system also has a tremendous amount of disk storage associated with it. So all of you know about disk that you permanently store information on in your computer. And typically in your laptop, you've got one disk in it. If you're lucky, maybe it's a couple hundred gigabytes. Well, we're again talking about tens of petabytes of disk storage on this machine. And in fact, there are over 40,000 disk drives that are on this machine. We expect one disk drive to be failing every day, at least one disk drive to be failing every day. And in fact, the machine has been designed so that this can happen, and the scientist will never notice that this has happened, because that disk will be immediately isolated from the rest of the disk, and the contents of that disk will be rebuilt in the background. So there are some interesting issues associated with this. Other than the massive numbers of cores, there are also the massive numbers of disk drives that are associated.
Well, and that, again, I got some callers here, we'll get right too, but I think that, again, points to what is, I'm sure, that a serious challenge. With a machine of this size and complexity, it has a lot of parts, and all of the parts have to work, and they all have to be working together. So you also have to have some way in real time and promptly to know, is everything working? If this piece is not working, you want to know that piece is not working, and then, you know, you right away, you want to know, okay, what are we going to do about that, so that there is no you don't lose anything in the process of trying to figure out what's not working right. Let's get that working so that that everything is going the way it's supposed to.
Blue Waters is a model of complexity. It is, as you mentioned, it's the number of cores, it's the number of disk drives, it's the amount of memory in the machine. One of the reasons that we actually selected IBM as the vendor for this machine was the capabilities that they have built into it to be able to continuously assess the health of the machine. So there are sensors all throughout Blue Waters that are telling you, are all the cores operating correctly? Is there a disk drive that's failing? So we're collecting all this information, and one of the things that we are doing with IBM is actually building a database system and data mining tools that set on top of that, so that as this information comes in, we can start looking for those kinds of anomalies. Because as you can imagine, in a system like this, you could be flooded with information actually coming off of the machine on its health, and a person could not necessarily determine whether a core wasn't working or not. So we're actually using computers to help analyze the data that is coming off the machine to tell us about the health of the machine.
I have several callers here. Questions are certainly welcome. Tom Dunning is our guest. He's director of the Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies and the National Center for Supercomputing Applications here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. He's also professor of chemistry. And we are talking about Blue Waters. It is scheduled to go online next year. And the expectation, at least at this point, is that at that point it will be the world's most powerful, publicly accessible supercomputer. Questions welcome 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You also may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have several people ready to go, and we'll take them in the order they came in, and we'll start with line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Urbana, but is the open house on, Oak and, St. Mary's?
That is correct.
Yeah, because you said Urbana, so some people wouldn't.
Yeah, that is Champaign. You're correct.
Okay.
And we'd be delighted to see you there.
Yeah, 4 to 6, right?
Four to six. That's correct.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you. And maybe I better just mention that again, just to make sure that we got this right. That's today. Open house today, the National Petascale Computing Facility. This afternoon, 4 to 6, and it is in fact in Champaign at
Oak and St. Mary's.
Oak and St. Mary's Road. So I'm sure people have driven by the building and seen it as it has been constructed.
Well, one of the reasons, and in fact we decided to have this open house, is that the number of community members who've watched the Petascale Computing Facility go up have marveled at how fast it went up. And we felt that, well, they saw it from the outside. Maybe they'd like to see it from the inside, too.
All right. Let's talk with someone now, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah. I was wondering what is going to be your policy on work by the Pentagon and the Department of Energy, the latter with respect to nuclear weapons explosions. I know that when Larry Smarr was the director of the National Center, he sponsored the use of the center to design the next generation of ICBM nuclear weapons rockets. And I think the center was also part of the stockpile stewardship computer program that simulated the explosion of nuclear bombs on behalf of the Department of Energy and the next generation of nuclear weapons. So I wondered what, if any, your policy is. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Both Blue Waters and the National Petascale Computing Facility will be focused on unclassified scientific research. That's really the only way that we can have this open-door policy to cover all areas of science and engineering. At the current time, most of the weapons laboratories certainly have all of the computing capabilities that they need in-house, so there's not a real pressing national need for this. But there is a very pressing national need to advance our knowledge in various areas of science and engineering. So that's what we're going to be focusing on.
And maybe just real quickly, I'm sure that there would be scientists all over certainly all over the United States who would think, well, this would be great for my research if I could be able to run something on this machine. How do you decide who gets to use it and in what sort of priority?
So there is a national competitive process that scientists and engineers have to use to get access to blue waters. So at least once per year, right, in the past few years, it's been once per year. There has been a solicitation from the National Science Foundation for award of time on blue waters. And so people, scientists and engineers from all over the country then compete for that time. Mm-hmm. Now, because of the investments made by the university in blue waters, NSF has actually allocated to the university a certain percentage of time on blue waters. And we'll be having a similar type of competition within the university to, again, raise the capabilities of the universities to be able to use advanced computing systems like this.
All right. To line three is next in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I share Francis Boyle's, Professor Boyle's concerns about the military use. Now, you've been emphasizing from the beginning that they do have these dedicated computers, but there's been so much contracting out of work that you would think that would be done in-house by the Pentagon to the tune. And one of the major players in that game, not perhaps the best, is SAIC, which has a major facility right next to, right in the research park, a special agent in charge. Very spooky. Gates was formerly CEO. He's now Secretary of Defense, so I'm sure they're getting some good Pentagon work. In fact, they have one program called the Deep Green, which is a battlefield, integrated battlefield systems management program that they've got a huge contract for doing. And I think that I wouldn't be surprised if Deep Green is simulated on and maybe actually used on Deep Blue. I think you'll protest to the contrary, but they will be allowed to get in line, I presume, to use the facility, and they would have the possibility of a direct line where they wouldn't even need to really encrypt super high-speed line, because they are actually so physically close, which theoretically doesn't matter, but, I mean, if you're going to be simulating such a massive thing as trying to control a battlefield with all the inputs, technological and otherwise, I think people should be worried about this and concerned, and maybe Google SAIC. It's amazing how little reporting has actually been on the. In fact, one of the better articles was in Vanity Fair some years ago. So I think the concern is well taken, and I hope there'll be more discussion of it.
Yeah, we certainly understand your concern. As I mentioned, this is a very open competition that NSF conducts for the machine, and one of the criteria actually is that work from that is being done on blue waters must be published in the open literature. So although I understand your concern, I think there are a number of safeguards that are in place actually to ensure that this machine is really used to advance our basic knowledge of the world around us as opposed to applications such as those you mentioned.
Well, as far from what you say, is it the case that, first of all, as setting aside the time on the computer that the University of Illinois gets,
right,
that other time, do you or does the University of Illinois have any say on who uses the machine?
No.
So that's the National Science Foundation.
That's the National Science Foundation. That's correct.
And then so as far as you're concerned and the university is concerned, only that portion that you get, they said, okay, this much time we've set aside for scientists of the University of Illinois, this is your time. That's that's the only part of this that you have any say on.
That's
how it
correct.
Gets used.
That is correct.
And then at that point, then, though, if somebody was doing work for the Department of Defense, would you take that into consideration as to whether or not you would say, all right, you can have this much time or not?
Again, what I would say is that the system will be run as a completely open system. Yes, we'll protect the data the scientists and engineers are generating, but we are not using the kind of protection that you would see in some of the major defense establishments.
All right. All right.
By the way, one of the things that you mentioned, I think, that would be worthwhile to comment on is although we do tend to look at big computer systems like this as focused on science and engineering, there are now many other areas of scholarship where this type of capability is becoming important, whether it's a social scientist trying to understand a phenomena which requires analysis of a large amount of data, work done by humanists trying to understand how thought patterns, certain concepts developed over time, which requires data analysis and text mining. So one of the things I think that's interesting, and one of the advantages I think that the university has with this time that's been allocated to it, is that we don't have to just use it for science and engineering. We can explore some of these new areas of potential applications.
Yeah. And will that be the kind of thing where there will be some way where periodically, if, for example, people are interested in knowing, well, what sort of work is being done, that's something that they can find out about?
Yes. All work that's being done on the machine is available, again, in a public database that people can actually look at what it is, that the type of work that's being done, even having an abstract that describes the work, all of that will be publicly available.
Mm-hmm. This morning, in this part of Focus, we are talking about Blue Waters. This is a supercomputer, and in fact, it is, as far as anybody knows, when it comes online next year, it will be the world's most powerful publicly accessible supercomputer. Scientists here at the University of Illinois and many other places across the country will be using it in their work. It's here at the university, and there will be an open house there at the facility at the corner of Oak and St. Mary's Road. The National Petascale Computing Facility will have an open house this afternoon from 4 to 6. So if you'd like to see what it looks like on the inside, you've driven by and you've wondered what's in there between 4 and 6 today, you stop by and you can see. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Tom Dunning. He's director of the Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies and the National Center for Supercomputing Applications here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. He's also a professor of chemistry. And questions are welcome. We have a number of them, and we'll get back to the phones and talk next with someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Two questions. Could you describe the physical size of Blue Waters? I'd like to create a vision for myself. And maybe the dimensions of one of the cores. I was excited to get a quad-core processor, so I'd really like to make a comparison. And the second question, it's the largest publicly accessible supercomputer in the world. Where does it rank with other supercomputers in size in terms of power? Maybe some of the ones you mentioned earlier the government use, if it's comparable to make a comparison like that. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, so your first question on the physical size, Blue Waters is approximately 5,000 square feet. So if you can vision something that's about 70 square feet on each side, or 70 feet on each side, then that gives you an idea of the physical size of Blue Waters. That's actually relatively small. The chips that go into Blue Waters, so the microprocessor chips themselves, are actually 8-core chips. So they're not so far away from what is currently available today. They are fabricated using IBM's 40-nanometer technology. So that's state-of-the-art technology, but that is not pushing the technology. So the chips actually are approximately the same size as the chips that are in your personal computer. What we have is that we have 40,000 of those chips in Blue Waters. Your question about where it ranks, we'll again have to see when the system is actually up and fully functioning, where it will rank on the list of the top 500. Right now, if it were functioning, it would clearly be number one, and it would be about five times more powerful than any computer that is available generally, and in fact about five times more powerful than any of the computers used for defense applications, although to be honest, we don't know all of the computers that are being used for defense applications. We only see a small window that they release information on. But that gives you an idea at least of where it would fall.
All right. And we'll talk next with someone in Bloomington, Illinois. Line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I was going to ask a question about what kind of, you know, maybe you could give us some examples of what kind of applications might be, you know, applied to this, you know, for example, I suppose, like, the creation of a hurricane, and that would be, like, a lot of data. You know, what other kind of applications could it be applied to, particularly from data rather than just the defense industry and theoretical applications?
So let me talk first about applications by two faculty members here at the University of Illinois. One is Professor Klaus Schulten, who's in the physics department, but is actually located physically in the Beckman Institute. And then Bob Willemsen, who is a faculty member in the Atmospheric Sciences Department, but is actually physically located at NCSA. So the project that Professor Schulten will be looking at is trying to get an atomistic understanding of how it is that a virus breaches a cell wall and manages to hijack our DNA machinery to create copies of itself. So you probably know that viruses are sometimes considered the smallest living things, but they actually aren't living in the classical sense in that they can't reproduce themselves by themselves. So what they do is that they actually grab on to some molecules that are on the surface of a cell and use those molecules to penetrate the cell and then take over our DNA machinery to make copies of themselves. That process, although we understand some of the details of the process, at an atomistic level, we really don't have a clue. And clearly, if we understood that process much better, we could much more effectively develop vaccines for these kinds of viruses or develop ways of coping with viral attacks. The work that Professor Willemsen is doing is actually very closely related to the tornado modeling or the hurricane modeling that you talked about, and that is he's interested in what are the atmospheric conditions that give rise to the formation of a tornado and how do those atmospheric conditions influence the path that the tornado undertakes. So he is looking at taking in data from Doppler radar systems, being able to use that, for example, to launch simulations of the tornado and then predict the path that the tornado is going to take. I know the long-term goals of this group is to move away from our current warn on sighting. So typically you get a take cover warning when a tornado has been sighted and is on the ground. What this group would like to do, and I have to tell you, this is a long-term goal. This is not something that they're going to accomplish purely with Blue Waters. But what they would like to do is to be able to warn on forecast so that they could tell people that in this particular geographical, confined geographical region, there's an extremely high probability of a tornado being generated by the storm that's approaching, and people should take cover immediately. So those are two of the projects that are ongoing here at the University of Illinois, and I think it's a real compliment to the university that these two groups have been awarded a very substantial amount of time on Blue Waters to investigate these problems that I talked about. Another group that we are working with on Blue Waters will be the group out in Southern California. This is the Southern California Earthquake Center. They are very concerned about the impact of a major earthquake on the San Andreas Fault on the city of Los Angeles. So this is actually a team composed of researchers from the University of Southern California as well as Carnegie Mellon University, and their goal is to be able to predict what they say, make a prediction all the way from rupture to rubble. So they want to look at predicting the slippage on the San Andreas Fault. They want to be able to model the passage of that shock wave, of the shock waves that are generated, then the ground motion that's generated into the Los Angeles Basin. And then they'll be building a digital model of the city of Los Angeles so that they can tell which buildings are likely to crumble, which freeways are likely to be damaged, what's going to happen to the gas distribution system, the electrical distribution system. So they want to get an entire model of what happens all the way from the earthquake to the impact on a major metropolitan area like the city of Los Angeles. So those are three of the projects that are being planned for Blue Waters when it comes online next year.
And maybe real quick, what is the cost of the computer? What's the cost to operate it annually? And how much heat does it put out?
So the cost of the computer itself is about $190 million. All told, this project will bring into the university about $350 million. So that's the cost of the computer, that's early operations on the computer, and then that's operating for the 5 years' worth of the expected lifetime of Blue Waters. Now, on the question of cooling, that's actually closely related to the question on how much power does the system consume. And that, unfortunately, is one of the parameters that IBM will not allow us to talk about at this point. However, what I can tell you is that the building itself is scoped to bring in 24 megawatts of energy. But, of course, there'll be a lot more in that building than just Blue Waters. So Blue Waters will be only a fraction of that. One of the things that we did, since obviously this is a significant amount of power, we actually negotiated with the National Science Foundation, so they pay for the power directly. The university does not have to pay for the power bill. The National Science Foundation will pick this up because they, again, this is, from their point of view, this is a national research resource that is for the benefit of scientists and engineers all across the country. The other thing that we did, however, is that as we started constructing the National Petascale Computing Facility, energy efficiency was clearly on our minds at the time. Fortunately, there is a lot of work being done in this area, and we captured a lot of those ideas in the National Petascale Computing Facility. In fact, it was one of the faculty here on campus in mechanical engineering that suggested that we put three water towers at one end of the building because it turns out that we can entirely cool the machine from the water in those water towers. We think somewhere around 70% or so of the year. So, in fact, during that 70%, there is zero cost of cooling the machine. During the other part of the year, we'll actually mix that water with water that's coming from the university's chiller plants. And although it won't eliminate the cost of cooling the machine, they will still dramatically reduce that cost.
All right. I hope that gets to the question of the caller. And we have just about 10 minutes left, and I have some other folks here who want to continue. The next caller is also someone in Bloomington, Illinois. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah, I've got a question. Sure. On a system that's so large and so open and does such important work, how do you go about doing the proactive capacity planning for that? And what sorts of business volume metrics or natural forecasting units would you use? Thank you. I'll just hang up and listen.
All right.
As you can imagine, scheduling something like Blue Waters is going to be a real challenge, and I think that's what your question really gets at. We actually have some very sophisticated tools that we use to schedule our supercomputers at NCSA. The NCSA has been operating supercomputers for 25 years now, so this is not something that's new to us. On the other hand, your question gets at the issue of, well, Blue Waters is a lot faster and a lot bigger than any of the systems that we currently have at NCSA. And so we'll certainly start out using the tools that we know about for scheduling Blue Waters. But my feeling is we'll also be developing some new ideas about how it is you optimally schedule a resource like this.
I'm sure that for the scientists who are going to be using it, that designing the program, that's going to take a lot of time. They're going to take a lot of time essentially putting together
the instructions, what it is they want the computer to do. And once that gets into the computer and however it is you start, you know, I don't know if someone clicks a mouse or someone pushes a button and says, okay, here it is, go. With some of these very complex problems, how long actually does it take the computer to do it? How long is an average run, or is it even possible to say that?
Well, there'll be a significant variation in the amount of time the computer actually works on any given problem. If I take the example of what Professor Shulton's group is doing, they're looking for blocks of time that run from 12 to 24 hours. Now, during that particular 12-hour slot, they may actually be investigating some particular aspect. Maybe it's exactly how the virus latches on to some of the molecules that are on the surface of a cell. So there'll be a series of those simulations that will be done, and they'll spend a significant amount of time actually analyzing the results of the simulation to make sure that they understand the processes that are going on.
And for those scientists who are going to be working using the machine who are not on the campus of the University of Illinois, will they do it from wherever they are?
We will be connected to the rest of the nation remotely. In fact, we have a tremendous amount of bandwidth that comes out of Champaign-Urbana going to Chicago, where it connects with all the national and international networks. And to be honest, at this point, we could flood Chicago with data so fast that Chicago would not be able to absorb it all.
Well, that's what at least I wondered about. So the band is there's adequate bandwidth to be sending back and forth this much.
Yes,
data.
There is. Yes. Amazing but true. Now, there will be some data sets that will be so large on Blue Waters that you'll never be able to move them. They will go on to our archival storage system, and scientists will analyze those by pulling them off of the archival storage system and doing the analysis and then putting the results back on the archival storage system. So it is correct that despite the fact that we have hundreds of gigabits per second going between us and Chicago, there will still be data sets generated by Blue Waters that will be so large you could never get them out of our archival storage system and send them anyplace else.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Tom Dunning, and we're talking about Blue Waters. This is a supercomputer on the campus of the U of I, scheduled to go online next year, and it is expected that it will be the most powerful publicly accessible supercomputer in the world at that time. Who knows for how long, but it will be. And scientists here on this campus all across the country will be using it in their work. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of focus. Tom Dunning is professor of chemistry here at the U of I. He's also director of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and the Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies at the U of I. And I guess one more time, we do want to mention, too, that there will be an open house at the National Petascale Computing Facility today, this afternoon, 4 to 6. It's at the corner of Oak and St. Mary's Road, and if you want to stop by and see it, you may. We had an email from somebody who wanted to know, can you bring cameras? Can you take pictures?
As far as I know, you can take pictures.
Okay. It is possible to take pictures. Also, this person is wondering, what happens if the power goes off?
Actually, as you can imagine, that is a major concern. The facility actually has power feeds from the university generation capability from Abbott. It has two completely independent power feeds from Amerind. So, in fact, we could lose two power feeds, and one of the power feeds could still run everything in the facility itself. So we can very easily lose one power feed, and you wouldn't see any interruption at all. If we lost two power feeds, we'd have to start gracefully shutting things down, but at least we would be able to do that.
All right. And other questions are certainly welcome. We do have time for a few more. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email is well-talk@illinois.edu. How is it? I'm sure there are a lot of places that would have been very happy to be the home of this machine. How is it that it's here at the University of Illinois?
Well, as you mentioned, David, the competition was very fierce. We had the state of California, their universities, and their national laboratories competing for this prize. We had the University of Tennessee and Oak Ridge National Laboratory competing for it, as well as the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center and Intel. I think we won it because of several factors. One was the long history that NCSA has of competence in really being able to manage and operate large facilities like this. But this activity really brought together NCSA, the computer science department, and the electrical and computer engineering department. And I think it was that powerhouse that really made us the winners in this competition. And it was severe.
And how long has supercomputing been going on here in Urbana-Champaign?
Actually, you would probably be amazed to know that it started back in the 1970s. The ELIAC 4 was one of the first parallel supercomputers in the world. Mm-hmm. And that was here. ELIAC stood for Illinois Advanced Computer. And so in some ways, you might look at the University of Illinois as being the birthplace of supercomputing, not the birthplace of computing itself, but the birthplace of supercomputing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and at what point do you cross the line between computing and supercomputing? Does it have to do with the speed or the number of calculations that you can do?
Yeah, typically, that's judged by the number of calculations you can do. But certainly, within the last several years, that line has gotten fuzzier and fuzzier. Back when I was a young student, it was pretty clear the difference between a supercomputer and a regular computer. But now they're tending to blend together.
Earlier in the program, we talked about what is it that makes it super, and we talked about cores, and we talked about the fact that it has like more than 300,000 cores, and that again, as I understand it, and I think about it, well, the more cores, the better. Is this something that is? How much can you scale that up? Is that infinitely scalable?
That's a very good question. In fact, that is a question on many scientists and engineers' minds, as well as computer scientists and engineers, is exactly how far you can carry it. Even though 300,000 cores sounds like a lot, we actually selected this computer to minimize the number of cores that it had, yet still reach a certain level of performance. So we were looking for extremely powerful cores. Our colleagues out at one of the weapons laboratories, Lawrence Livermore, are getting a machine that will be comparable to ours, and it'll have 1.6 million cores on it. But when you ask a scientist and engineer, what would you rather have for a comparable level of performance, 300,000 cores or 1.6 million, they'll go for 300,000 every time. Because it's just difficult to break the work up in so many ways to make efficient use of the computer. So they want to break it up the minimum amount. They would prefer to have one core that had 10 petaflops of peak performance.
Well, and
but we can't do that.
And I'm sure you get into serious questions about power consumption and dealing with the heat that it's going to generate. So, the more cores, the bigger it is, the more electricity it's going to use, and the more heat you're going to have to dissipate.
Yes. And actually, one of the other reasons that we selected this particular computer is it is a water-cooled computer. Mm-hmm. Everything in the computer is water-cooled. The memory, the processors, the hub chips, that results in about a 40% savings in power. So that particular aspect of the machine alone makes it very energy efficient.
Now, is that why it's called Blue Waters?
That's one of the reasons it's called Blue Waters. Okay. We're also on the shores of the Great Lakes, so that was another reason for the waters in the name. And, of course, as many people know, IBM has long been referred to as Big Blue.
Okay. You also mentioned that the life expectancy of Blue Waters is 5 years?
It is about 5 years.
So,
that's correct.
When 2016 rolls around, what happens? You just turn it off?
We'll turn it off, and hopefully at that point we'll be turning on a brand-new computer.
And so other than possibly having more cores or maybe something about the machines that will make it to increase the power, maybe you wouldn't need to have more cores, or something about them will be more efficient, or you know, whatever. I mean, what are you looking at that would be the next thing that would be a big jump from this?
So typically, computing technology has evolved. We've occasionally had disruptions, like when we switched from scalar computers to vector computers, and when we switched from vector computers to parallel computers. But typically, there's been an evolution with a few punctuated changes. Well, we're going to go through one of those punctuated changes, and I think nobody knows at this point just exactly what an exascale computer, as opposed to a petascale computer, what kind of technology it's going to be built on. And the U.S. government is actually ramping up a number of studies and a number of research programs that are now going to be looking into the technologies for an exascale computer.
And does nanotech have something to do with that?
Well, if you think about it, microprocessors are all about nanotech. So I talked about the 45-nanometer process that Blue Waters is built on. Intel itself is already starting to move to 22 nanometers for some of their new chips that they're going to be fabricating. And that's going to go down to 14 and 11. And yes, it is all in the nanoscale era, and it's all going to be figuring out how you really construct these complex chips using sophisticated nanotechnology types of approaches.
Well, I think at that point, we're going to have to stop. We'll say one more time that if people are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you're interested in seeing what the inside of the National Petascale Computing Facility looks like. They will be having an open house today from 4 to 6. Again, this is the building. It's at the corner of Oak and St. Mary's Road. And as we've discussed, I'm sure a lot of people have driven, in the course of its construction, have driven by. And if you thought to yourself, gee, I'd like to know what it looks like inside, this is the chance. And just real quick, essentially, what is there to see?
Well, you're not going to see much because there aren't many computers in it at this point, but you're going to see the power distribution system that we have in the facility. You'll be able to look down underneath the floor under the computers to see where you cable all the computers together. And then one thing that's very impressive is that you see the huge gallery that the computers were actually set in. This is a 20,000 square foot gallery that they set in. So, yes, you're not going to see any computers, but you're going to see where they're going to live, and you're going to see how they're going to live during the next 5 years.
All right. Our guest, Tom Dunning, he's director of the Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies and National Center for Supercomputing Applications here at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. He is also a professor in the Department of Chemistry. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I certainly enjoyed talking with everyone.
Just before we go here, we'd like to remind you that the month of June is winding down, and we are happy to say we've made some real progress toward reaching our goal of $2.1 million in membership support. And right now, we have a little over $244,000 yet to raise. Every contribution, and it doesn't matter the amount, every contribution brings us one step closer. You can make your renewal or additional gift, and you can check our progress by going online at willpledge.org. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stick around. There's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine and the host of that show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. In Kansas City, July wheat trading at 493.5. That's up 3. September, 504.5, up 2.5. In Chicago, July wheat, 463.25, up 2. September, 479, up 2.25. July corn, 356.75, up 1/2. September, 366, up 1/4. December, 377.75, up 1/2. March, 390.5, up 1/4. July beans, 956.25, down 1.5. August, 945, up 1/4. September, 930.75, up 3/4. November, 924.25, down 1/4. January, 932.5, down 1. July meal, 286.40, down 60. July oil, 38.01, down 12. June live cattle, 89.72.5, down 32.5. August, 88.90, down 27.5. August feeder cattle, 110.57.5, down 32.5. September, 110.25, down 40. July lean hogs, 80.85, down a nickel. July crude, 76.32, down 1.32. 35. The U.S. dollar, 85.82, down 27. The CRB index, 262.62, down 153. On Wall Street, the Dow is off 47 points at 10,362. The NASDAQ off 8 at 2298. The S&P 500 is off 4 points at 1110. It's noon.